I would ask you not to be too comfortable, too laid back. It really does require a certain posture of attentiveness and receptivity. And the posture often carries a sort of leniency in that direction. So please be aware of how you sit and how you attend. It really does require a full-hearted attention. There's just no question about this. This can't be listened to as an intellectual exercise or goes nowhere. It goes right back to where we were. And next year it's like a broken record. For it to be an embodied experience requires a different receptivity of the mind and body and a willingness to let it transcend, move through into the body in ways that are not induced through the concepts. And we'll get more into that today in the dyads, which I will explain. And we have dyads today? I think we do. Yeah, we have dyads. Okay. So what we've been talking about and we'll continue to speak about for the rest of the day is this phase one and phase two process that all meditators go through. Because we only know ourselves as ourselves and have only conceptualized the world and also ourselves within it, when we start our spiritual journey, it's there that we begin. We have to begin where we are, and that is where almost all of us are when we begin. So we can't expect to transcend the self quickly, but you can hear from more experienced meditators and teachers where this journey ultimately goes. Now, you can get so self-insulated that you aren't even going to pay attention to that and just focus in on the pains that you have in terms of your psychological orientation or your physical process or whatever's going on that calls you to meditation in the first place. But it's always good to have half an ear or a full ear out for where this journey goes. What direction does it go in? And it gets arrested throughout if we don't realize that the sense of self is the main obstructor, the main obstruction in being able to move seamlessly towards the freedom that is pronounced as the direction of the journey. So we acknowledge that the first phase of the practice, which can extend for well into years, has to do with self-satisfaction. That is, it has to do with self-promotion. It has to do with self-contentment. It has to do with sort of tidying up the loose ends of ourselves that have been dangling since we were children. A lot of the self-assumptions that keep bubbling up, we have to address. We have to look at the emotional implications of what we do, the psychological implications, the secret parts of ourselves that we don't want to divulge, the hidden components that we don't think anyone would love, including ourselves. Those all have to be kind of revealed to ourselves. And in fact, in my opinion, that's what's happening to the country at large, is that that part of the country's prejudice and is starting to be exposed. It's being exposed at a different level than just granting voting access or whatever citizenship or whatever it is. It's being exposed at a deeper psychological container. Now, when that's exposed, there is a part of us that rises up in joy for that exposure. And then there's the shadow part that comes in immediately afterwards. Immediately after Obama, what did we expect? We expect, at least my thought was, oh, there's going to be a shadow here. Quonk! Sure enough, there was a shadow. That shadow is equally as important. Understand what I'm saying here, is equally as important as the personification. That is, unless you see what resistance remains, you don't realize, you just get lost in the joy of having a person of color president and what that means and how it's all going to be great after. But no, it's not going to be great after, because the shadow shows you what is left to deal with, what are left to address. If you didn't see the shadow, you might not even think there was anything left to address. So you bring that shadow front and center and you say, okay, so how does this pertain to me? Not just become a person who scolds others for having prejudice that I don't have, but we all do. If you were raised in the centuries, in the decades that I was raised, you do. And so you have to say, okay, so this is in me. I want to know it. I want to make it understandable. So too, there is a phase of Dharma practice where we have to deal with our intra-psychic issues in exactly the same way. You keep seeing the shadow as that's present in terms of our reactivity, in terms of our anger, in terms of our expression of violence and road rage and all of that stuff. But if you don't see that as what's still left in us in terms of the prejudices and opinions that are hardened inside of us, you just try to deal with road rage as road rage. You don't see it as that that sense of being self-confined and having everybody tell you what to do, and that there's something wrong with you, and here's this guy passing you, and you're not even, you know, the intolerance of all that shouts itself out. But we don't see it as that. We see it something separate I have to deal with in myself called road rage, has nothing to do with my self-anger. It all fits in together is what I'm saying. And so this phase of the journey, phase one, is very, very revelatory in terms of one's own psychic responses. And we have to take it seriously. You aren't going to thin if you bypass those pieces, because those pieces, when undealt with, are the very thickening of ourselves when those patterns arise, or when the circumstances where those patterns can arise. And so this is not incidental work. This is not secondary work. This is not psychological work. This is spiritual work in its essence, because they trap us. It traps us inevitably within its grip. If we don't respond to it and look at it. So there's that point. And then there's, you know, we're also cultivating all this time. We're trying to line ourselves up to what our projection of a spiritual person looks like. We're trying to be better. We're trying to be good. We're trying to do all this. Now, that's a trap in and of itself, because anytime the self is in charge, whatever is that's arising in you isn't going to be good enough. So I may be becoming more moral or more ethical, but I'm not becoming ethical enough. I'm still lying from time to time. So if we get caught in the trap of self-improvement, even as we are working to cultivate certain qualities of heart, then we're going to get lost in that circular pattern that never ends as well, because you're never good enough. You're never going to be good enough. So the point is that you really begin to see that, or get a sense of the heart thinning. That's what this is about. The ethical conduct is about thinning oneself, not about doing it perfect or doing it well, because that's a thickening. You can feel it when you get self-condemning about how poorly generous you are. I'm not very generous. Oh, she gave that and I only gave this much. There's the thickening. So you get a sense of what the indicator is the thickening, the density of me, the self-opinions that come back in. I'm trying to describe density, self-density in lots of different ways so that you can get a feel of it for yourself. Or the sense of lightness and the sense of just, okay, you know, we're doing this as best as I can. I'm doing the best I can here. And so there's a smile on your face even as you slip and tell lies or do whatever it is that you think is against the premises of your spiritual journey. They're not. They're in favor of, because you're learning about the nature of self as you're going through this thing, rather than becoming self-perfect, which is an impossible task. So you understand, this is really kind of a crucial point. All right, so really take that in now. Take it in. I don't like to keep talking until I have a sense that you've integrated what I just said, because there is such an important issue. It's no sense in moving on until we understand that, because you don't move on. You just circle back. And the reason is that many of us don't have the intention to move beyond self-gratification is that we've never had it to begin with. We aren't self-gratified. The practice has worked, or can work, so much against us that we can't breathe in it. You know, my concentration is poor and I don't have enough sila, and I'm not generous. All of it. And so why do you want to practice? It shows you what you're not or never could be. You see, so this has got to work in favor of the flow and movement of selflessness all along the way, from the beginning to the middle to the end. And so it needs repetition. It needs teachers to say to you, look, this isn't what we're doing. We're not trying to be moralistic here. We're not trying to be righteous. We're moving out of self into the thinning of self. These behaviors work in that direction as long as you don't circle back and start judging how selfless you are or how selfless you aren't. Okay, so now there's a transition. But first we have to realize that the transition is to step out of everything we have known. There's no, this, I can't say this with more sincerity. Some of us have been dealt a bad psychic hand, that we have, extraordinary areas of depression with this, chemistries are off, manic depression. We have lots of things that our mind is just working against us, seemingly. And so we try to push ourselves through those psychological difficulties, because we really feel the urge of our heart to move into freedom. The urge of the heart is real, but you have to take in account all the things that you're dealing with to move forward. And sometimes it's not the best goal to move too quickly or even towards a sense of self, which can create more confusion, which adds to the turbulence and sends us back into an episode of depression or manic or whatever it might be that we're facing. So you have to take your whole self into consideration. Say, okay, this may not be the lifetime or the time that I want to move in that direction. Let me just thin myself in this lifetime. Keep myself front and center and just thin it. Thin it out as best I can. Open my heart as best I can. Loving kindness the best I can. Generosity the best I can, without comparing or contrasting the practice I'm doing with somebody who's practicing anatta and seems like they're in some kind of who knows where space. Okay, so this just isn't the time to do that. Fine, not a problem. You have to see that this is a much larger time frame than a few years if we are taking it sincerely. And at the same time, and this again is not a contradiction, awakening is immediate. It's immediate. And it may not, and you can't push it faster than it is, than the opening of, you can't push it faster than you're naturally able to open. So you just, patience. That's a parami. That's a thinning. Patience is a thinning. Why? Because impatience is a thickening. So I want to lay the landscape here so that there's no one that falls outside of this trajectory that we're on. Okay, But now we're moving on, because some of us are hell-bent to do so. And others, it's the right timing to do so. So when we're moving between the phase enhancement, self-beautification, self-thinning, we have to realize that we come to a point in which, as long as the self is in the center and focus of our, even if it's thinning and thickening, it still is there. And it really obstructs a general understanding of the mystery that we sense we are beyond it. And so this occurs organically. It's really not a force of will, because a force of will is coming from the wrong focus of effort. Effort becomes very important at this point. In the self-sustaining phase of practice, or the self-thinning phase, your effort is the only effort you know. So you got to use it. In the shifting of identity outside of self, your effort has nothing to do with this. Nothing. Because your effort actually complicates the picture, obstructs the picture, because it brings you forth again. When you bring willful effort to bear upon yourself, you obstruct the very path that you want to take, which is outside of yourself. Okay? So just understand that now it becomes paradoxical. But not just how we work this thing. We have to start understanding all the different ways the self plays itself forth, how it embellishes itself, how it uses circumstances to arise, not only in terms of opinionation, but we'll get to most of that in the course of this weekend. And so we have to be very patient with ourselves, and we have to want to understand the self, not try to eliminate it. There's nothing the ego likes better than somebody who's after its demise, because it feeds off of that kind of effort. Yeah, it says, I ought to get rid of myself. Well, who's saying that? And so it's just this back and forth play, ping pong match that goes nowhere, circles back on itself, that we have to be very careful of at a time when the old patterns of self still arise within this new confrontation or this new organization of how the reality begins to shift outside of myself entirely. So now we have to look at the Buddha's teaching in a very different way, rather than as something that I need to do. And believe me, I was caught in that pattern at one point. I went through my early years of practice, not early, right on through being a monk, really, or early years of being a monk, where I thought, God, this whole practice is self-made. It's me. I decided I needed more concentration. I decided I needed this. I decided I needed that. All of it I successfully, or less or more so, was able to accomplish. And I thought, okay, so what have I got? I've got me now with this muscle and that muscle and this muscle, but nothing. There's no transcendence in any of this. I'm still me, more muscular. I mean, psychic muscles. So this isn't going anywhere. I'm sharing my frustrations because I can't be alone in those frustrations. I know some of you, because of the years of decades, some of you have been practicing, must feel it as well. So you take stock and you think, okay, I've been, this direction, nobody was telling me this, you know. Not until I got to Nisargadatta in 1980 did I even know that I was moving in the wrong direction. And I mean, his wisdom cracked that open almost immediately. He says, you can practice this way for the rest of your life and you'll end up exactly like you are now, except a little shinier. He says, you're like a person carrying a flashlight trying to run beyond its beam. When you're ready for those kind of lessons, they penetrate, believe me. God. So I had to step two. I had to figure out what was going on. And It's a complete different track, a complete different way of moving forward. If moving forward it's even wrong to say it's moving forward at this point. What becomes the centerpiece is for us to understand the dynamics that are necessary to make this approach useful and to actually grow into it. And those dynamics are diametrically opposed to the dynamics of phase one. And that's just the way it is. Now I'm going to use an analogy. Analogies are only partial, but this is as good of an analogy as I can think to kind of show you the two shifts here. Okay. So if any of you have any age on you at all, you remember the time when you go to the movies and there was a movie reel that was showing the movie. Basically, it was a reel of single film, you know, single shots of film that were extended over the length of the reel that moved quickly enough so that it all looked like a blurred picture of someone actually moving with light shining through each of the projector would shine light through this images and project it onto the screen. So what we saw on the screen was a movie. And we got fascinated by the movie. The movie was contained all the dynamics and storyline that our minds contain, just in someone else's shape and form. And we saw our own self dynamics on the screen and in the form of other actors or a different storyline or a different narrative or whatever. But it's basically a human being going through what I've go through in my life with in different measures. And that was very satisfying. You could enjoy it or not, or want a different mystery or dynamic or drama or whatever one's tastes were. And that was the movie. But let's look at what we're seeing. It looks three-dimensional, doesn't it, when you look at a movie? It's not. You look at the film and it's two-dimensional. So already we're off in terms of our ability to project our life onto a flat screen and a flat film that just has light coming through it. Now, the reason the whole thing is even observed, or we can take part in the story, is because of the light that's shining through the images. The images themselves was what captures our attention, but we could care less about the light. But without the light, the whole thing is dead stop in the water. This is very similar to our situation, in which the film of the mind, the narrative of our own mind, creates the film of what we see on life and through life, and what happens to us in life, and our interpretations of what happened to us in life. But it would be nothing without the light that shines through that the mind space. Now, the light, consciousness, awareness, is not in the film. It holds the film so that you can see it. But just like the projector that shines through the images, it's not a part of the image itself. It holds the image and is the reason that you can even understand the image. It permeates and infiltrates the image, and you wouldn't have a movie or a set or a storyline without it. But it itself is not the storyline and is unimportant to us, because what we're interested in is what the story is saying about us or to us. Now, it's interesting because when I was younger, every once in a while, the film would split. I would sit there, you'd sit there and groan and in the theater, and you'd wait patiently a few minutes until they sewed it back together or stitched it back together and started it up again. What it left was unless they forgot to, usually they forget to turn off the projector, would just be a screen with light on it. And it would meant nothing to us. We sat there waiting for the story to occur again. Okay. This is a slightly off, but it has its own point. The quieter we become about the storyline, the more the light shines forth, the more the light is revealed. But unless we want to embrace the light, we will wait for it. We won't be quiet enough for it to really shine forth in all of its dynamic. We'll wait until the storyline, meaning our thoughts and emotions and narrative, begin again so that we can re-engage. And there will be times in practice when your mind is naturally quiet. And it will kind of shock you a little bit because you're not used to a mind that's quiet, and you'll think about having a quiet mind and stir it back up again with thoughts about what it is that's occurring and what did I do right or wrong to make this occur, and this is different, I don't know what's going on and all of that. And I'm sure that's happened to some of you. Instead of just being quiet with it, you see, instead of beginning to let the transformative element that's been behind and through everything, like the light through the images of the film, instead of really embracing the light, the consciousness, the awareness, we want to start to think we're waiting until the movie starts up again. The quieter you become, so this is the dynamic that sets us in the right tone. The quieter we become, the more light is seen and less storyline. The less storyline, the less sense of me, the thinner I am, until there reaches a point where the film fractures. That's called awakening. And there's just light. Now, that could last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 10 hours, 10 days, 10 months. It can last a long time or a short period of time. Doesn't matter. Once it breaks and there's just light, you see the dynamics of everything. You see how you depend upon the sense of self, what the sense of self is. You see the whole range of what is ultimately at the end of that sense of self. And inevitably, in almost all cases that I know of, the film stitches itself back together and goes off and starts running again. And you're left with the memory of the breakage. That memory of the breakage doesn't go away because it was a true seeing. And it etches itself on our heart. And you can never forget it. And you can try to forget it. And you can go a long period of time where you involve yourself in other ways. And I've known people who, you know, this was a real shock, this breaking of the film, if you follow what I'm saying. Threw them off, and they got so scared that they, like an ostrich, they tried to bury their heads. That's why timing is so important in all this. That's why staying within ourselves is so important. That's why all the preparation that I've been talking about all day long is so important. Because the shock can send us back the other way, and we can go scrambling. We can't forget what occurred, but we can sure make it hard for it to reappear. So, again, you know, we have to take stock of ourselves and see where we are in all of this. Do I really want to go forward? Well, some of you do, some of you don't. For those of you who don't, you might be interested enough just to listen to how the rest of this manifests. For those of you who do, come on. I'm certainly willing. I'll go with you. I know it's safe. I wouldn't send you somewhere that wasn't safe. I wouldn't do that. Why would I do that? At some point, the self thins, where you, even wherever you might be in your own practice, you know, you don't want to hurt anyone, do you? That's not, you just don't want to harm. You want to manifest on the earth with as little harm to oneself and others as possible. That's the real first indication that you and I are thinning, is when you really don't want to hurt anyone else. Vengeance is not in the picture. Okay. So now, what is it? Let's look again at what the light itself was showing us. The light was showing us, at that moment, everything stopped. There was just light on the canvas, on the screen. Okay. One of the ways we keep from seeing the light is to keep ourselves in perpetual motion. Keep this film running. Keep the storyline going. One of the attributes of meditation, it's supposed to point you towards, is that we are sitting still, not moving. Everything else that inside of us is moving. All of that is still going on, but the shell of ourselves is not moving. And the less we invest in what is moving, the more all of that movement begins to slow down in relationship to the shell that holds it. It begins to slow down. We have less thoughts. We feel more, guess what? All the things that we really look for in meditation comes in that slowing down. We become more content, more open, more heartfelt, more caring. Definition of which is self-thinning. It's the momentum that keeps us going. It's the thinking that keeps us in that constant forward motion of ourselves. That forward motion, as I mentioned at some point today, has nothing at all to do with it has everything to do with the thickening and density of self. But if we are interested in moving this thing towards transcendence, then stopping is essential. So what does that mean, stopping, you see? Well, let me just give you a quick example of it. I mean, my mind is full of being productive. I mean, it's just, I don't think there can be any more of a conditioned reinforcement in anyone's mind than mine. In terms of productivity, being useful, being productive, staying active, doing the next thing. Well, that keeps you, keeps me, keeps anyone that has that tendency from really being full and present to what is occurring. That's the stopping that's necessary. The movement on to that mental frame of reference of the next thing, brushing my teeth, wondering what I'm going to do immediately afterwards and how I'm going to get to work and when I'm at work, when I'm going, all of that endless betrayal of the moment is how I keep myself going. Literally, how I keep myself going. That's counterproductive to the shift in strategies and methods that this transition to transcendence needs. It needs us to be cooperative with what we know to be the essence of what obscures the present moment. So if I can just change references to the screen with just the light, okay, it's stopped. It's not in motion. So now my life needs to become aware of how I keep motion going for my own sense of self-protection, self-momentum. So now I'm going to make that a focus of watching my productivity in terms of what the next thing I need to do. As soon as I make my awareness expansive enough to be able to see that pattern in me, the awareness that sees it is not in motion. So I'm beginning to understand that the awareness has already stopped, just like the light that shows through the moving film has already stopped. It's stopped. It's just light on a screen. It's the motion, lateral motion of the film across the light that is the momentum. But if the light can see that in movement, can see me in movement, my mental movement, then that's the beginning of the direction that I need to take in order to come to a complete stop. That's very important because there's only you now that can make this, that can change this direction, that can alter the thinning of the cells, phase one, into the shifting of identity out of self, phase two. That you can listen to teachers, you can listen to people who have some realization of that. But you have to do it yourself. You have to find out what it is that keeps you in movement, keeps you from stopping, and address that as seriously as you would undertake any project in your entire life. You have to be extremely serious about this. What's going on in me? You see? Now, tomorrow, I'm going to show a couple of meditation techniques that shift in that direction so that you have some way, some methodology for being able to address the movement that's inside of us, because that's what's keeping the light from being seen. And I'm going to give you many, many little glimpses, twists that says, look at this, now look at that. And that shifts you out of your perspective of movement into the perspective of stillness. Just like I offered the luncheon homework, which I can't remember what it was at the moment, comes in the moment. But it was an attempt to get you to completely arrest your normal movement towards future, using the past as a guide towards future. This whole thing has to do with the stopping, the stillness, the moment itself, the moment itself. The moment itself holds all the passage of time and all of the past, but it is not defined by the past. It is not defined by that movement. The movement will go on as long as it goes on. What we need is the context that holds that movement so that we can be assured that we're not moving along with it. Our spiritual heart is not moving along with it. And that takes, for me, it took a couple of methods that, again, I had to develop on my own. Mostly, I had to develop them on my own. In fact, this whole way of seeing, except for very few rare beings, you sort of have to self-discover